Thank you, everybody. I'm Nick Gillespie. This is a special live version of the Reason interview at the Ron Paul Barbecue, and I'm joined by Fox News personality Kennedy.
Hello.
Late of MTV, and the former and future representative of Michigan, I hope, Justin Amash.
Yeah, thanks, Nick.
All right. So, let's start out by talking about Ron Paul, this so-called Dr. No. Justin, you served in Congress. You're a congressman, or you were a congressman like Ron Paul. How did Ron Paul change the game as far as you're concerned?
He gave us hope. When I was first starting out in politics, there was no one like him. Absolutely no one. We hadn't seen presidential candidates like that. We hadn't seen people in office like that. Someone who would just come out, speak the truth, talk about liberty, talk about the things that were really the hallmarks of America, like what made America genuinely great. Mm-hmm. Our beautiful Constitution, the way we like held up in high regard our ability to make decisions for ourselves. And he just reminded us of these things, that these are things that make our country special, and we don't want to lose that. There's so much negativity in politics. There's more today than maybe ever before. And what I'm reminded of is how hopeful he was. And it wasn't really a focus on all the negative. He would speak the truth and say it and set it with his particular kind of charm and charisma. Mm-hmm. And he didn't mind that people would make fun of him, criticize him. He stayed positive. He stayed on message. And for people like me, someone who was coming up in politics, to have that kind of role model, mm-hmm. that made all the difference. It gave me the energy to go forward.
Yeah, and you were in the Michigan State House?
That's right, yeah.
And so, I mean, it is hard to recapture, obviously Ron Paul entered politics in the 70s, but then in the 2000s, during the George Bush years, it's kind of hard to recapture, there had been, the contested election, 9/11, bunch of weird stuff, the global war on terror. We were in two shooting wars. And then Ron Paul is saying, like, hey, maybe we shouldn't be all over the place.
Yeah, I mean, he was the right person with the right message at exactly the right time. And there were people who were open to that message right at that time. And I like to say, a lot of things in politics are the result of chance. Mm-hmm. You have to have not just the message, you have to be there when it's needed.
Right.
And he was there when it was needed, and it made a difference. And, I think that you would have a whole generation of liberty advocates who would not be around right now if not for Ron Paul.
We actually talked to somebody else, myself and some Reason people, were talking about how there's babies walking around that were conceived at Ron Paul events. And I was like, I don't know if I want to know about that, Kennedy.
Are they your babies?
I don't know. They're not my babies, or at least not. I can't claim them as tax exemptions. You were established as you came up at MTV and you were their resident Republican. You were a weird kind of iconoclast, like an anti punk, so you were a certain kind of Republican. What did Ron Paul mean to you when he started showing up in the aughts?
The idea when I started learning about libertarianism was libertarians were very skeptical about the Republican Party, and a lot of that skepticism was justified after 9/11. Mm-hmm. And, one of the big philosophical debates was, do we try and branch off and make the Libertarian Party viable, which they, on the federal level, they have not been able to do. So there were people like Ron Paul that, was... Remember O.J. Simpson?
I do remember O.J. Simpson.
He was asked about, why wasn't he out there protesting in favor of the civil rights movement? And he said, I'm not black, I'm O.J. And I feel the same way about Ron Paul. He was like, I'm not a Republican. I'm Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And
but so, don't bring up the civil rights stuff.
Fair. No. Or white Broncos.
Yeah.
Because he's very sensitive about both of them.
I can imagine.
Yes. But the point is, his ideas were more consistent and transcendent than whatever vessel the Republican Party offered. And he was fine being a part of the Republican Party and carving out his portion of it because he was never going to abandon his ideals.
Yeah.
It was like Robert E. Lee. He was never going to fight for the Union. He was never going to fight against Virginia.
I
bring it full circle.
I'll put Robert E. Lee was a traitor to the United States who fought in defense of slavery. Ron Paul is up here, right?
Like, oh, yeah, yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah, so. I'm no Robert E. Lee fan.
I don't know. You just introduced him into the conversation in a way.
Well, so. Sometimes you have to draw these complicated metaphors, and our history is complicated.
It is.
But what Ron Paul did was refocus the Republican Party where it should have been in the first place. And it got so far away from itself after 9/11 that, you know, it was very interesting to see people like Justin Mosch, Thomas Massie, and Rand Paul very receptive of those ideas during the Tea Party movement, which was, you know, a natural progression of where the party should have been and where it should be now.
Yeah. Justin, I mean, you got elected to Congress as part of the Tea Party wave. Describe what that was like and, you know, where that energy clearly came from Ron Paul, right, from the 2008 campaign. How did you ride that? And, like, you know, again, I guess you were talking about politics is, you know, having the right ideas, but then also being in the right place at the right time. That seemed to be one of these moments, right?
Yeah, it was a combination of people being upset with the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. What they saw as massive overreach with Obamacare, with Obama generally.
Yeah.
And, you know, you had the Ron Paul movement that was there, and then you had a bunch of conservatives who are not necessarily, deeply ingrained in the Ron Paul movement, but were adjacent to it.
Yeah.
And I think the messages came together, and it was that rare moment where a lot of the people who I think could form a very strong foundation for a party, a political party or a political movement, came together and were strong. You had constitutional conservatives with libertarians, with some more traditional conservatives. And these people were all anti-establishment. They were against what was going on in Washington. And they were really predominantly focused on liberty, limiting government. In many ways, I think it's quite different from the movements you see today, where with at least a large part of MAGA, at least at the political level, it's about consolidating power, extending power. How can we use power?
Using it for our end?
Yes. How can we use the power for our end? And the Tea Party movement was about how can we reduce Washington's power? Yeah. How can we reduce its grip?
What happened, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, you know, the Tea Party and the Occupy movement kind of rose up contemporaneously. And you had, it's all fascinating that you had Ron Paul, kind of the titular head of one, and then Bernie Sanders. So you have these old guys who are like unbelievably, who are speaking to young people in a way they hadn't been spoken to in generations, and who are authentic and real. And it seemed like, circa 2010, 2012, Tea Party people were being elected. Nobody got elected from the Occupy movement. And now it's kind of like we're still talking about the 1% and nobody's talking about stopping spending. What happened to the Tea Party energy? Because it seemed like it was right there and it was building towards a libertarian moment. Everybody was interested in reducing the size, scope, and spending of government.
So I can speak from my perspective as someone who was elected in that Tea Party wave, served in Congress, and did see our influence grow in the first several years that I was in Congress. From 2011 to about 2015, I saw a group of people who got elected as Tea Party Republicans, Tea Party conservatives, or Tea Party libertarians, in a sense, who were figuring out how to use the system that we had in Congress to assert themselves more. We figured out how the leadership team worked. Mm-hmm. We figured out how the legislation passed through, and we started to use the levers that were there to exert our own influence on the process. And then my perspective is that the personality of Donald Trump really absorbed a lot of this. A lot of the people who were like populist in a large sense, you know, they were fighting the system. They got pulled into that movement. And while there's some overlap in some areas, they have largely different goals and approaches.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of the energy that was then in the Tea Party movement, it just fizzled out. I remember a lot of my Tea Party supporters and friends from my district back home who would say, look, people aren't coming to the meetings anymore. Mm-hmm. They don't care as much about the Constitution. It's not really about limiting government anymore. It's more about how can we go after the left? How can mm-hmm. we use government to greater effect? And I think that just there was a gradual diversion, and eventually that Tea Party movement just didn't have enough people coming to the meetings anymore.
Yeah.
They just weren't showing up, and it's basically gone. And in Congress too, we saw a group of people like the House Freedom Caucus who came mm-hmm. together. You know, I was one of the founders, built something pretty big and powerful.
And it was designed around, you know, cutting government spending, regulation, yeah. and power.
Absolutely. I mean, I was the one who wrote the mission statement.
Yeah.
So, like, I know exactly what it was about. I think it might still be on there, on their site. It's on their X page and everything. So I wrote that, and it was all about making sure the people are represented, making sure that we limit government, that we expand liberty. And that all fizzled away. And now it's largely a rubber stamp for, you know, what the Trump administration wants. Mm-hmm. To the extent they push back, it usually fizzles out within, you know, a couple
this
weeks.
This is like with the big, beautiful bill that put up a fight, but not.
Yeah, look, I'll give them some credit at times. They get this or that piece. They say, like, okay, we're going to push, and they'll get some piece added to the bill. But in this large scheme of things, we're talking about, you know, taking it from, you know, extremely bad to almost extremely bad.
Yeah.
Like, so just like, it's a little bit better than it was before.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's unfortunate.
So, you know, Justin was talking a bit about Trump, you know, maybe Trump didn't kill the Tea Party or that energy that, you know, and there was a definite libertarian energy. I think, you know, a big part of it was that Bush was disastrous. I remember whenever he left office, 2009, I got to write an anti-Bush analysis for the Wall Street Journal. They asked me to say, like, you know, from a libertarian point of view, why did George W. Bush suck? And part of it was, like I said, he discredited.
Did you write a 50,000-word
treatise? Yeah, I know. It's still, you know, it's coming out every a few words every week for the rest of the eternity. No, but it was like he really discredited even to big government conservatives. Like, oh, man, we are just terrible at this. And, like, everything we touch goes to hell. He left office, which were I think he had a lower approval rating than Nixon, you know, when he left. I mean, it was just disastrous. And then you had Obama come in and immediately say, hey, I'm going to overhaul, you know, there's a financial crisis going on. I'm going to keep bailing out companies that don't need it or don't deserve it with tax money that's not meant for them. And I'm going to overhaul government. People were like, okay, libertarianism is starting to sound pretty good. Trump kind of put the kibosh on that, right? Like, from a cultural perspective, because you were working at Fox News, what's the energy of Trump? Like, you know, this is a guy who has, like, it might be a negative charisma, but, like, he's pretty incandescent.
He's very charismatic. Like, I've met him several times.
Yeah.
And he's funny, and he's one of those politicians like Bill Clinton, because even Obama didn't have that. Obama was transformational, and Obama was a great speaker on big stages, but, you know, kind of prickly and really not the kind of person. He doesn't really like people. Yeah. And, you know, that was kind of evident when he would do his White House press briefings because he was adversarial and he was always resentful that people would push back at all on his horrific ideas.
I hated his playlist. Do you remember he would do his iPod playlist and it was always like
Queen.
Yeah.
And it was like,
it's like, well, you know what? Like, I think anything that demeans the Queen is okay. You know? But it was not a good gift.
Yeah.
But Trump, you know,
libertarians have not benefited from a transformational candidate since Ron Paul.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate because unfortunately, you do need a transformational person to break through all of the noise because people aren't getting their messages the way they were 15, 20, 30 years ago. They're just not.
Yeah.
And you don't have to compromise the message, but the messengers have not been the kind of people who were able to.
It seems kind of like people don't want, you know, Ron Paul's message. It's, you know, he was Dr. No because he voted no on every spending bill.
And Thomas Massey is the only one in Congress doing just that now. He's the only one, like, I'm pretty confident that Justin would have voted against the.
Well, there's a reason he's not in Congress anymore.
Or whatever the hell it's called.
Well, your one yes vote was to impeach Trump, right?
Yeah.
So that was kind of like, okay, I'm putting two bullets in the chamber while I'm playing Russian roulette.
Yes.
But, you know, so Ron Paul was Dr. No in that he didn't vote for spending and stuff like that. But he was also Dr. No when he ran for president. He was saying, like, I don't want to run your life, you know, and the government shouldn't run your life. The government shouldn't run the economy. America shouldn't run the world. Like, no, I'm saying no. But
Trump had a lot of that as well.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that, you know, he really took up the consistency with the charisma in a way that other Republicans hadn't, because, you know, we had been faced with multiple dynasties from the Clintons and the Bushes, and there was a threat of Jeb hanging over everyone in 2016. And, you know, Trump is one of those people who absolutely believed in the things that he believed in and was very uncompromising for whatever reason. And you can disagree with that. But, you know, he was the one saying everyone else in NATO has to pay a bunch of money. The trade surpluses are, you know, that's the trade deficits that the United States are running. It is incredibly unfair to us and to American workers. And that kind of stuff did resonate because he didn't deviate from that, because every other politician triangulates.
Right.
You know, that's the whole Clintonian magic, is saying something to the base, but then changing your tune almost completely when you get to the general election. And Trump was never willing to do that. And I hope that there is a libertarian or libertarian Republican who is as unyielding and is as effective a communicator, because these are ideas that generate passion, and you can't just give up on them and say, well, no, these are theoretical concepts, so I'm going to be pretty chill about it.
Well, what I was going to ask, though, is, like, is, you know, do people not want control over their lives? Do they, you know, because this is this part of the rejection of libertarian ideas or policies, at least at the federal level? And, in a profound way, I think there are so many libertarian wins on things like criminal justice reform, drug legalization, a lot of economic regulation, things like Bitcoin is a libertarian project, and it is now firmly ensconced in the world economy. But, you know, it seems to me like in 2010, people were like, hey, give me back my money and give me back my life. And now maybe people aren't quite so sure. They're like, you know, give me somebody else's money and I'll do whatever you want.
Yeah, I think the world has changed a lot because of social media. I thought it would be transformational in a way that benefited libertarianism. And you talked about some libertarian wins. And I agree. I think libertarians are often too down on the progress we've made. I think there are ways in which we've made progress as libertarians. But when it comes to social media, I do think there's been a lot of downside in the sense that we are now seeing everything that everyone's doing. And people feel this compulsion to get into everyone's business now. You know, you see something halfway across the country and you say, oh, that's my problem too now.
Yeah.
I want to make sure that I talk about that problem. I want to make sure that I'm offering ideas about that problem that is in a city that I'll never visit.
Right.
And that not...
I'm very concerned about that red light in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Like, why aren't they doing something about that?
Right. And that didn't used to be the case. It's put us into everyone's lives in a way that didn't happen before.
Yeah.
And I think that does have a tendency to create bigger government and more controlling government. And I do hear a lot of conservatives these days talking about how everything's, you know, important. You know, they used to be, hey, let people live and let live. And whatever happens somewhere else, that's not my business. I care about my community.
Yeah.
Now it's like, oh no, this thing that happens halfway across the country, that impacts me. So I want to make sure.
Okay, but I'm from Portland, Oregon, and that city has absolutely gone to hell because...
When is the last time you lived in Portland, Oregon?
I haven't lived there since high school, but I go there all the time. My entire family lives there. Yeah. My parents live there. My brothers and their kids and their partners, they all live there. You know, it's like my brother was in law enforcement for a long time. He's still a shooting instructor at the police academy. Okay. And, you know, my sister-in-law works from home because downtown Portland is a shithole where people are scared to go out. And it's because they don't prosecute the bad people. And these are not libertarian ideals.
But that's, you know, it's like, that it's has like nothing to do with social media.
Okay. Right? Yes, it does. Okay. Because if you've got people in New York who are responding to things that are happening in Portland, it's because they don't want the things that are happening in Portland and San Francisco and these once good cities that were amazing and perhaps had libertarian philosophies and ideologies in the 70s. They don't want that infecting the rest of the country.
So that's why New York is about to elect a democratic socialist.
Okay, but see, living in New York City, I've seen that stuff ruin cities like parasites and consume them from the inside out. Those are not libertarian ideals.
No, of course.
Statists running all of those things. And the fear is that that brand of statism is going to infect everything at the local level. And what are you left with? You have no economic mobility. You have drug addicts who are not receiving treatment, but in places where there's drug decriminalization, not legalization.
Yeah.
People are thrown on the street like pieces of human garbage.
Do people then move to Texas? I mean, we're in Texas. I don't know.
People do move. But, people in Portland move to Idaho because Idaho's a lot freer than Washington State or Oregon, unfortunately.
Yeah. And you see, that's a positive outcome of social media that we know better what's going on in other places.
And what can happen. Yeah. And what can happen to your town if you're not vigilant. And if the good people don't run for office, then everything gets taken over like the Rajneeshis.
I think on average what it does is it creates more busybodies. What you end up with is a bunch of people sitting at home who don't really know that much about the particulars of that city or that situation. And I don't disagree. There's a lot of bad stuff that happens in cities all across the country. I'm as libertarian as anyone, and I'm sure I disagree and disapprove of all sorts of things. But I also remember one of the most important aspects of libertarianism that isn't talked about enough, which is humility. Mm. You have to appreciate that you don't have the knowledge of everyone else's situation. In the same way that I don't like someone coming to me in my life and telling me how I should improve my life when they know very little about it, I also think we have too many people now who are just pundits about every single issue across the country. They see a video, the video shows something going wrong, and they know, they act like they know everything about that situation, and they just don't. And I think actually this is very harmful to libertarianism. It's harmful to the ideas that we believe in.
So we're like a nation, and I'm much older than either of you or both of you put together, but on Bewitched, there was a nosy neighbor named Gladys Kravitz who is constantly like peeking in the curtain trying to catch Samantha, you know, wiggling her nose and turning somebody into a goat or something. But that's, we're a nation like that. What do we do with that though, Justin? Because social media is not going away.
That's right.
So like, okay, this is the world we live in. You know, how do we use that to our advantage, or how do we minimize the negative of that?
I think that's the complicated part. You know, I don't disagree that that is hard to resolve.
Yeah.
You're just going to have more and more social media.
Right.
There's no way around it. There's no turning back the clock and having us not know about what's going on across the country. So I think
Wouldn't it be beautiful if, and this is a late, and I'm sorry, I apologize for, this is a late boomer fantasy as an older parent. You know, I want to be, you know, that family scene where you all are fighting over the one TV and that's it. So you're together, you hate each other and you're all forced. Like if there's five of you, four of you are watching something you dislike, but isn't that so much better? It's a better America than where we're all watching like 90 different things at the same time.
No, I'm actually very optimistic for a younger generation of people because they are their own kind of libertarian.
Okay.
You know, it's not necessarily the Bob Poole libertarian who was there essentially at the ground floor when Reason started.
Right.
It's not the Tea Party, Justin Amash, constitutionalist, explain every vote on Facebook kind of libertarian. They see things in their own lives that they find unacceptable. And as parents, we have to constantly explain to them, like, the worst things that happen in society are because government is so intrusive.
So but you have two daughters.
I do.
And are they constantly showing you stuff on, like, Instagram? And you're like, you know what? That's because of the government.
Yeah, we talk about it all the time. We do. We talk about, like,
the Yankees lost again. The government.
Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, probably the federal subsidy at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah. There shouldn't even be a stadium there.
Yeah, it should be just a dirt lot.
That's right.
With, you know, in Justin's America with some sticks and some discarded golf balls. You know, that's what we used to call baseball back before talkies.
Yeah.
But kids are tactile. They are rediscovering things like that. They are rediscovering analog and record players.
Well, and, I mean,
like my older daughter came home from college and now she's obsessed with card games and Yahtzee. And, you know, it's not just.
It sounds like she's going to be worshiping the devil in a couple weeks.
Hey, man, as long as she can.
When she brings home that Ouija board.
Three card Monty in Times Square.
So let me ask. So this is an interesting question that, you know, like one, you know, and not to get really simplistic about it, but one definition of libertarian is like, you know, people who are annoyed at being bossed around. Like, I want to be the boss of my own life. And obviously, you know, when you're 10, you don't have the same decision rights you have when you're 20 or, you know, whatever. But so, I mean, you're saying that like younger people in the social media context are like seeing all of the ways in which they're getting kind of forced to do stuff that they're not into, and that's kind of a proto-libertarian. That's going to spark a new type of libertarian reaction.
Absolutely. I have so much more faith in this generation than, you know, it's like they are painted with a broad brush as being lazy and entitled and stupid. And they're not. I mean, it's like a lot of the guys that I talk to, my daughter's guy friends, a lot of them don't want to go to college because, you know, college hates them. A lot of them don't want to be Democrats because they have been cornered as the misogynistic oppressors of society. And, you know, they will forge their own paths and, you know, they will find their ways to trade schools because of populists.
Yeah. Do you think there's something to that? I mean, sticking with this idea of social media as having, you know, I think I agree with you that we assumed like making more things transparent would just make things better. People would be able to express themselves, but maybe it's like they're getting more bossy. But do you like, how do we change our attitude towards this stuff? Cause it's not going away.
I think we have to develop, as libertarians, this appreciation for the idea of humility. I don't think we talk enough about it as libertarians. I agree that we're not going to stop seeing things that are going on across the country. And much of it is valuable to see and to hear about and to learn about. I mean, I think kids today know more than kids did in previous generations. Yeah. I think that's a positive thing. I think they're more interested in a variety of things than previous generations. You know, I get excited when I see the things that my kids are interested in because I do think it's different from when we were kids. It's very different. They have a broader scope than we did as children. But we need to develop this idea in people. And I think it's important as parents. It's not a project of the government. This is important just as parents and churches and communities. This idea that we don't know everything about everything. I mean, maybe some of this is like my Orthodox Christianity speaking out too, that we don't understand.
You don't even know how to, the proper way to worship Christ.
We don't.
Right? I mean, if you're a Protestant, you know, or a Catholic.
I'm also an Orthodox Christian.
It's on mystery.
Yeah. Yes. No, okay. That's great.
Yeah. And so we don't necessarily know everything.
Yeah.
And so this doesn't mean we shouldn't have opinions about it.
Right.
But we should.
And you have to act.
We just have to, but we should act with a certain level of humility about what we know and what we don't know. And this is the great message of like a Hayek, right? And who's been a big inspiration to me is that sense of humility.
Right.
And I don't think that's a big enough part of libertarianism today and not enough a part of just ordinary families today. That's not enough of a message to children. Hey, you know, that thing that you see, it looks bad. Maybe it is bad, but let's learn about it.
Yeah.
Let's try to understand what's going on. And I think that there's more of a rush to judgment these
days. How do you get there? How do you, I mean, you're obviously doing it, I mean, through your religious practice, but you're, you know, the way that you're raising your kids, the way you build your life, you know, how do you scale that up to people who might not be believers or, you know, just in a world of politics where, you know, I'm thinking you're from Michigan. I believe Illinois is adjacent to Michigan. My geography is getting worse with every minute. But, you know, the governor of Illinois just signed a bill and was touting it that, you know, now all public school students are going to have mental health evaluations done at the school. And it's kind of like, well, this is kind of amazing, right? That you would be doing this. So
yes, unless it keeps you from at some point owning a firearm because a government controlled institution is giving you a government created mental health survey that could later be used to determine.
I'm saying this is like monstrous, right? You know, that you're talking about like, you know, the public school teachers in Illinois, like a failed state, you know, is going to now start dictating, you know, what is mentally healthy or not on your kids. But like, so how do you scale out from what you're talking about, which I find interesting.
I mean, I don't think it requires religious belief or faith to have this attitude. I think it's just about telling your kids or you know, talking to your family about this generally, that we don't know everything about everything. You have to have a healthy sense of skepticism. You have to have a willingness to say the truth is more complex than we understand. And to slow down, to think about things, to learn to not trust everything that you see, that a lot of manipulation happens out there. So you can't necessarily trust everything. I see a lot of people these days who will see something on TV and they assume it's true, or they'll read something in an article and they assume it's true. And it switches. Sometimes it's, conservatives falling for something. Sometimes it's progressive.
And we all love motive.
Jeff
we love
told
stuff
me that Sidney Sweeney really is a Nazi. And I was surprised.
Oh, really? So she really does have good genes, G-E-N-E-S, right? So here's I guess this is related to a broad conversation about libertarianism. Because for me, one of the selling points of libertarianism, you know, from the time I started reading Reason in high school in like the late 70s, was the idea that not everything is political. Like, politics matters. Like, I don't think any of us are anarchists. There's going to be a realm where, you know, you have to build a consensus, and, you know, that's never good, but you squeeze it down to the smallest amount of your life possible so you can just get on with stuff. But, you know, everything is political now, including like these, you know, American Eagle ads, which who even knew American Eagle still existed, as a brand. But that is, you know, every action you do is
like
heavily
Pulitzer. Eagle when it's on a silver dollar.
There you go. Yeah. Preferably minted by an underground dispensary or something backed by cannabis.
Fox News commercial.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Justin. Roslyn Capital.
Yeah.
What I keep in my safe.
Yeah. Whatever G. Gordon Liddy was selling, I'm buying. But no, but like, how do we get to that point? This is related to this question of mystery or that we don't know, but also like where not everything you do is political, like that some things are just outside the realm of, you know, listening to, you know, politicians talk about it.
Well, the problem is the idea of everything being political benefits a two-party system, and
yeah,
it really benefits both sides who compete for hysteria and, you know, making people as anxious and obedient as possible. And you can't have a conversation over Thanksgiving dinner without it veering into politics if you have people who are looking for fights like that. And, you know, people are looking for fights as a distraction from their own problems and their own mental health crises, you know, which oddly enough are oftentimes generated by politics. And then you've got politicians who are eager to solve them with, you know, funding from the government where they can then later use that data to further control your life.
Yeah. Justin, are you going to, you were a 10-year congressman.
Yeah.
You did your time, but are you going to get back into politics? You ran for the Republican Senate nomination in Michigan. Lost to Mike Rogers, who then lost, correct?
Yeah.
Am I remembering? Yeah. And
Mike loses again, but.
Yeah. Mike Rogers is a loser, I think. You go to the dictionary and he's there. But are you going to get back into politics?
Well, I think I'll run again at some point. Mm-hmm. Probably not in the immediate future, but at some point I will. I mean, the one of the nice things about getting into politics early is that I'm still pretty young.
Yeah.
If I ran again for office in 10 years, I'd still be younger than the average politician in Washington. So,
and you are, just to be clear, you are 80 years old.
That's right. I just look very good for my
age. But you're 80, but that means you're on the low end.
It's the holy oxygen that he rubs into his skin.
Yeah. I just look very good.
Yeah. So, yeah. So you think, but what will you do in the meantime then?
Well, I'm thinking about writing a book. I mean, about some of the things we talked about here. I mean, I think humility as a concept is important and not talked about enough, not written about enough. But I'm going to continue to give speeches. I'll continue to post things. I'll continue to write. And I will run for office when I think it's the right time to do so. And I think that in this environment, it is not the right time. You know,
would you ever run for president as a libertarian?
I wouldn't say no, that I never would.
What would be more attractive for you? Because you've talked about how much you hated being in Congress and how you have more power as a private individual than you ever did as a representative. So would you rather be a member of Congress again and be swallowed whole by all of the clowns?
Would you rather be 100 congressmen or one large duck?
Yeah, exactly. Right?
I would say I have about the same power as a typical congressman.
Yeah.
When I'm outside of Congress, we both have the power to post on X. Mm-hmm. And that's about all the power that the average member of Congress has.
I mean, in a slim majority, if you are the no vote that can turf something, that's pretty powerful.
Well, I mean, he was the no vote.
I was that for 10 years.
Yeah.
And things got progressively worse in Congress.
Yeah.
They continued to consolidate power at the top.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that I felt the impact I had more acutely after I left Congress, because I would just be out at Costco, for example, which is like apparently the place where everyone comes up to me to talk, and people would tell me how much they appreciated that I was explaining the votes, that I was willing to cross the aisle to do the right thing on a whole host of issues, including civil liberties and some of the war issues out there. So people appreciated that, and I think there is that marginal benefit to at least my community, mm-hmm. that they are able to see that into people across the country who might follow what I'm doing. There's also the possibility of maybe someday I can trick enough of them to choose me as Speaker of the House.
Right, you know, without being in Congress. And because you don't have to be a member of Congress to be Speaker.
If you, I think it's a lot easier to do it if you're in Congress.
Yeah.
They're highly unlikely to do it outside of Congress. Mm-hmm. But the
but you don't,
is,
technically, you don't have to be a member of Congress.
You don't technically have to be.
Yeah.
But the point is, it's the opposite of the power hungry. I want to devolve power from the speakership. The only way you're going to do that is to get someone in the speakership who will say, I'm not going to exert this power. Right. I'm not going to force you to do this. I would open up the House, let people do what they believe in.
Yeah.
Put things on the floor with no expectation that my preferred outcome is going to win. It would be a very different sort of speakership, and I think it would be very good for the institution. It would be great for representative government, and it would also decrease the influence of the presidency. The reason the president right now has so much influence over Congress is because he knows he only has to negotiate with two guys. Mm-hmm. If he goes to talk to Mike Johnson and John Thune, that's it. Game over.
Yeah.
If the president knows that he has to talk to 435 members in the House and 100 members in the Senate, that's an uphill battle for the president. Because then he says to Mike Johnson, hey, Mike, I want this. And Mike's like, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Speaker.
Yeah.
My hands are tied. I'll put things on the floor, but I don't know what these guys are going to do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Mike Johnson's not going to do that. He's not going to cross Trump.
Yeah.
I would be willing to say, hey, Mr. President, I'll put it on the floor, but I can't guarantee any outcomes.
Yeah.
And that weakens the presidency. So I think not enough people understand that the interaction between the legislative branch and the executive branch is a big part. It's not just that Congress isn't exerting its power. It's the system itself that it's become so concentrated in the power of the Speaker and the Senate Majority Leader has actually empowered the president because he doesn't have to negotiate with that.
Right. Who was your favorite House Speaker?
Oh, man. It has to be before the time I was born, probably.
Maybe Nancy Pelosi, right?
So
she probably treated Nancy Pelosi probably treated humble. You better
he's
than anybody.
Pelosi was one of the worst speakers.
But I mean, as bad as John Boehner, like she never accosted you in a cloakroom.
In the time that I was there, John Boehner was probably the best speaker.
Wow.
And I tried
better than Paul Ryan?
Oh yeah, much better. And I tried to oust John Boehner multiple times. And he was probably the best. I would say maybe not even by a small margin that he might have been the best speaker. Because John Boehner, as much as he would swear at me and do all that stuff, he would allow me to put amendments on the floor. He would make some compromises. He would allow us to vote on a variety of things.
Right.
He would invite us into the office to have a conversation.
When
Paul Ryan got in there, it was like, okay, I don't need you guys.
Is that an individual problem or like, you know, I mean, it's just you need somebody who's not a complete power monger.
I think for someone like Paul Ryan, there was such a belief in his own ideas, his own policies getting enacted, that he needed to grab control. Nancy Pelosi also always brags about, I won't put anything on the floor unless I know it's going to pass, which I think is a terrible way to operate as Speaker of the House. John Boehner was a little more old school, a little more willing to let things go. Mm. And my value, like as a person, is in the principle related to the process.
Right.
Okay. I would put that above any of the outcomes or positions I have. I believe strongly in the process. I believe in America.
Yeah.
And I believe the process can produce good libertarian outcomes.
And the process is not tangential. The process is the point, right?
The process is everything. People don't think enough about this, but what separates America from the other countries in the world is the process. We have abundant resources, but there are other countries with abundant resources. What is different about this country, there's a cultural difference, of course, but there is a process difference in our government. We operate by a set of rules. We don't operate on arbitrary whims.
Let me, because both of you are optimistic and that belief in, maybe not in the process, but of like putting stuff out there, and the optimism that you both exude brings us back to Ron Paul, whose birthday we're celebrating. You know, Kennedy, I'm moved by like how, you know, optimistic you are about your kids or the world your kids are growing up in. Can you talk about, you know, is there anything out there that you worry about that's going to screw up the world? Like what's your biggest fear for them?
Unfunded debt.
Yeah.
Our debt worries me more than anything.
Really?
And I know there are people like that truly believe in modern monetary theory.
Yeah.
I'm not one of them.
I've tried to live by it personally, and it doesn't work.
I wish that were the case. I wish you could just make money and magically pay all of your own bills.
Yeah.
That and OnlyFans.
Okay. So, but that's your big thing. What about you, Justin? As a, you know, what worries you? What would turn you into a non-Ron Paul pessimist?
Oh, well, I don't know about that, but I think the single biggest risk is AI.
Yeah, and you're for it or against it? God, this is a French goodbye question.
I don't think there's any way to avoid it. It's kind of like what we talked about with social media.
Right, okay.
Social media is going to increase. We're going to know more about each other's lives. There's no going back. AI is going to happen whether we like it or not.
Right.
I think the outcome is a little bit out of our hands. I'm not sure that there's a way to make it work, and it might work and it might not. Mm. And I don't know what the outcome will be. And I do think, you know, as a libertarian, I say this, and a lot of libertarians are very pro AI and for no regulation on it, et cetera.
It's because they want sex robots.
I understand where they're coming from, but the, not about that part.
Yeah. But by the way, we just call those robots. You don't have to say sex robots. Yeah. It's all robots or sex
that
robots.
That's very kind of you.
Yeah.
I understand where they're coming from as a general matter.
Yeah.
But there is a high risk here with AI. It's the kind of thing we're not really prepared for. I don't think that those who are in positions of power right now, and I mean not just people in government, but people who run these companies, have prepared the American people and the people of the world enough for the kind of change it will bring about, and the potential for altering human existence in a way that is so profound that we might not even think of each other as humans in the same way.
Wow. Okay, that's a great note to end on.
Sorry, that's such a dark note.
No, not at all. But I want to thank Kennedy and Justin Amash for talking on this special live edition of The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. I, of course, am Nick Gillespie, and we are at the Ron Paul Barbecue and 90th Birthday Party. Happy birthday, Dr. No, and we'll see you at your 180th birthday as well.
Happy birthday.
Unless the AI turns out not to be.
Let's hope it's peaceful AI.
Yeah. That's right. Thank you very much.